Welcome to The Rest is History. And we have just been recording, haven't we? We've just got off a really fun episode that we've done with Lucy Lethbridge, author of the book Servants, about servants, about the real Downton Abbey.
The real Downton Abbey. And it features an absolutely, although I say it myself, brilliant version of Downton Abbey, featuring multiple impressions.
It's got a remarkable introduction, that's all I'll say. Yes.
But it will be coming very soon. And then what have we got? We've got the Cathars coming, haven't we?
Yes. Are you up to speed? How's your Cathar prep going?
Do you know, it's an incredibly complicated subject. So the Cathars are supposedly the shadowy dualist church that coexisted with the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, centered in the south of France, and inspired both the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail and the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
So you might think, listening to that it's almost too good a story to be true. And whether that is actually the case, we will explore. But it is a very complicated but fascinating subject, because I think it's one of those stories where the kind of the fantasy of it, the fantasy that you get in novels and films and so on, is wrong, but it's wrong in a very interesting way, and a way that actually dovetails with a lot about what scholars have said.
Right.
Anyway, I think you'll find it very, very interesting.
Have you been to, I'm sure we'll talk about this in the episode, so we're anticipating, but have you been to those Cathar castles in the Languedoc?
Monségur.
Yeah, all those places.
The Masada of the Cathars.
Pépiteurs, or whatever they're called.
The last holdout. And Carcassonne, of course, with its great medieval battlements, which were all made in the 19th century.
Should I say that Carcassonne is fake, but the real Cathar castles are real, aren't they? I mean, no, they're amazing.
So Monségur is not the castle that was stormed in the 13th century. But this is the castle. It's kind of like the Masada, the last stand of the Cathars. And the Cathars are meant to have escaped from it, carrying the Holy Grail and all this kind of stuff. What the truth is, we will be revealing.
So do you know what I've been doing to prepare for this?
Have you been reading the Da Vinci Code?
I've been reading the Da Vinci Code.
Have you read the whole thing?
I can't honestly say that I have, Tom.
Have you not read it before?
No, oddly.
You're such a cultural snob, Dominic.
I'm not a snob.
You and your highbrow tastes. I remember we were digging up the garden. We were kind of laying out the garden. We just bought the house.
Yeah.
And I kind of sloped off, and I can't remember how I'd picked it up. And I read the first page, then I read the second page. And then I read the whole thing in one sitting.
Oh, my God.
And Sadie kept saying, come out and, you know, lay the patio or whatever. And I said, I can't. I've got to finish this. I thought it was a terrible book. The prose is awful, obviously. But I'm not surprised that it's the success it was, because it's unbelievably readable.
The incredible thing is that all these chapters begin with short Wikipedia-style descriptions of the places.
So it's a bit like the rest of history.
So, well, no, but he will... They'll arrive at a chateau and it'll say, for example, the sprawling 185-acre Chateau Villette was located 25 minutes northwest of Paris in the environs of Versailles, designed by François Mansart in 1668 for the Count of Uflay. He's literally just copied this from an encyclopedia.
But there's a kind of honesty about it, I think, that just slips down very easily.
Right, well, we will be discussing
And also,
this.
I love the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. Did you read that?
Yeah, well, we'll definitely be talking about that.
So I don't know how many listeners have read that, but that was, it was a massive, massive publishing phenomenon in the 80s, was it?
Yes,
it came out.
82, I think.
And it had a kind of black cover with red writing.
That's right.
And basically the thesis of that, which then gets kind of picked up by Dan Brown, is that Jesus married Mary Magdalene, that they came to the south of France, that there was a holy bloodline, and that there is a kind of shadowy organization that guards it.
It's called the Priory of Sion.
The Priory of Sion. Yeah. And this is what the Cathars were.
Yeah.
The authors of that sued Dan Brown. Anyway, listen, we're doing the podcast. We've got to stop.
I will be talking about this on that. This is going to be my contribution to the podcast.
Yeah, so we've got to stop.
Anyway, so we've got that to come. But we've just released the episode on Egypt's greatest female pharaoh, Tom.
Hatshepsut.
Yes, which you were very excited about. Why did you choose her?
So we've got our list of points and questions from Sam for doing this. And he says, the episode on Hatshepsut is out today, a topic many will know nothing about. Why does it make a good topic for an episode? It's true, Hatshepsut is not maybe a household name in the way that, say, Cleopatra is.
Yeah.
But I think ancient Egypt is one of the absolute red-hot bankers for any history series, don't you think? I mean, it is absolutely up there with Hitler and the Tudors and all that kind. I mean, ancient Egypt is probably the single most visually, iconographically familiar ancient civilization.
But the weird thing about that, though, Tom, unlike the Nazis or the Tudors or the other sort of big hitters for British listeners, people's interest in ancient Egypt, when you say, why are you interested in ancient Egypt? What do you know about it? They will refer to the studies of ancient Egypt when they were four.
Yeah, so it's very primary school friendly.
Because it's usually the first thing you do, yeah, isn't it, in school, before you can sort of read or do ancient Egypt.
So it was kind of tied up with me. I had quite a traditional Church of England upbringing. And so it is part of the Bible story. It's part of, so the story of Moses and all that kind of thing. Egypt obviously plays a key role in Pharaoh and his chariots being drowned in the Red Sea. I mean, that is, I think, a part of it, maybe less so now. But in primary school, of course, it's the first thing you do, partly because it is the first civilization. I mean, it kind of stands in for the first civilization because its monuments have survived in a way that the monuments of, say, Mesopotamia haven't.
Yeah.
But also the fact that you do have those monuments. So I would say that the three pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx are probably the most recognizable monuments in the entire world, wouldn't you?
I think it's absolutely right.
The Eiffel Tower, the Taj Mahal, perhaps.
No, but they're much more recognizable than those. So a lot of children would not know what the Taj Mahal was. I would guess every single British child would say those are the pyramids.
Yeah, not just British, I mean across the world.
Or mummies.
So there is this disjunction between the kind of the renown that Egypt has as a topic and the fact that we know so little about so many of its key figures. I think people are interested and do know about, say, mummies, pyramids. I mean, that's the stuff of popular TV.
The Valley of the Kings and uncovering tombs.
But I think that it's difficult to bring, say, a pharaoh alive for reasons that we actually discuss in the episode, which is that the individual is merged with the sense of the ideal. And therefore, probably the two most famous pharaohs, I mean, certainly the most interesting to discuss, are the two where there is a tension between the individual and the role that the pharaoh is called to play.
So that's Hatshepsut and
Akhenaten. So Hatshepsut, because she's a woman, and therefore there are all kinds of tensions that we discuss in the episode. And Akhenaten, who is the subject of a previous episode that we did on Egypt, because he rejects so much of what is expected of him as a pharaoh. Yeah. I guess the only other pharaoh whose fame would rival those two is Ramesses II, and that's because he is absolutely the archetype of a pharaoh, because he rules for so long, he's so successful, and he's so unbelievably boastful.
Is he the pharaoh in the Bible stories? Or if I've got that wrong? I just always imagined that
the pharaoh in the Bible stories is not named.
Right.
There is a town called Ramesses that is mentioned in the Exodus story, and so his name is associated for that reason. But he's also, I mean, he kind of serves as not just as an emblem of the glory of Egypt, but of the arrogance and the collapse of Egypt. So he's Ozymandias, as in the Shelley poem, I Met a Traveller from an Antique Land.
Oh, yes.
And he sees this, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings, look on my works, ye mighty, in despair. And then Shelley describes how nothing beside remains, and, you know, the vast expanse of the sand stretching away. And that's prompted by Shelley going to the British Museum and seeing this great bust of Ramesses II.
Apparently, that's a bit of an urban myth I read on
Wikipedia. Oh, is it? Yeah.
They think that Shelley wrote the poem while Ozymandias was on his way. While it was on his way, so he anticipated it.
Right.
And there was a lot of talk about it coming.
Well, actually, no, in my defense, I tell you what, I am muddling that with, I think, Coleridge going, or one of the romantic poets going to the British Museum and seeing the bust of Amenhotep III, who was the father of Akhenaten, and seeing in his smile, his enigmatic smile, the smile of the opium eater.
Crikey, that's harsh.
No. Maybe it's authentic. But I love this idea of romantic poets going and being influenced by the images of these great kings.
But I think dissing the ancient Egyptians for hubris is foolish because, I mean, their civilization lasted thousands of years. I mean, what are you looking for from them?
Yes, but it's absolutely a part of the inheritance that we have from the Greeks and from the, and obviously from the Bible.
Yeah.
So I think Egypt is mediated for us by the Greeks and the Jews.
Because the Greeks were so conscious of it having declined, you mean? Because of its former glory and all that.
It's the Greeks in the form of Herodotus who identifies all the things that continue to fascinate us. So pyramids, mummies, gods with strange heads, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And again, Herodotus is kind of interested in individual pharaohs, but he gets them all wrong. Whereas he does get, you know, he can absolutely describe the things that we continue to find fascinating. And the Jews, because Egypt serves as the archetype of an idolatrous polytheistic state.
Yeah.
And Pharaoh, you know, it is shorthand for an imperious pagan king. And I think that that's part of our inheritance as well.
You know, the World Cup of Gods, I was very, very...
Yeah, you loved Anubis, didn't it? And I felt that I'd cheated.
I did feel you cheated. And what I didn't tell you at the time, I don't think, was that when I was 6.5, 7, I made a papier-mâché head,
Dominic,
of Anubis.
I thought that you seemed unusually...
Yeah, because each child
was
given a god. Each boy was given a god, and mine was Anubis, by Mrs. Mason. And I made this head. And I think then what happened, Tom, and this is why it was very personal for me.
Yeah.
I got tonsillitis. So I didn't get to wear the Anubis head on the day like all the other boys did.
Dominic.
A lot of work had gone into it. It was all for nothing.
If only you'd said this at the time, I would have understood your unhappiness and your rage and your resentment about it.
Well, because I didn't want to make it all about me, Tom. I'm not a snowflake.
No, so that's so big of you.
I'd been triggered and I'd suffered harm, but I didn't want to, you know, make it all about myself. So,
yeah. I'm sorry.
Just throwing that out there so you feel bad.
So it's kind of like wolves being dumped out of the cup or something.
By who?
I don't know.
By Liverpool.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, but I mean, that comes around once a year. I'm never going to do that head of Anubis again.
That's true.
That was
I tell you what, Dominic. Why don't we aim to do an episode on Anubis? And it can be shorthand for...
Can he sustain an episode, Tom?
Yes, because we can make it all about mummies and the Day of the Dead.
Right.
Sorry, the Book of the Dead and all that kind of stuff.
I think you're tantalizing me with that, but I think when it comes out, it'll be called Mummies and Anubis will be pushed out of it.
No, it will be called Mummies, but we will open it with you and your primary school trauma.
Yeah.
We'll center Anubis at the heart of it.
Okay.
So one other question that Sam asks, which is, do you always aim to intersperse the ancient and modern when planning out episodes? I think to a degree we do, don't we? I mean, we, not just ancient and modern per se, but we try and vary the periods. So the episodes we put out in January was unusual, I think, that we had
lots of Nazis.
We had lots of Nazis. So we had the Holocaust and then we had the rise of the Nazis.
That's right.
And that was for logistical reasons that we'd recorded the episodes with Jonathan Friedland quite a while earlier, but we couldn't fit it in because of the World Cup and all kinds of stuff like that. And we really wanted to put that out as soon as we could. And then the Nazis was the anniversary. But otherwise, generally, we do try and get kind of chronological variety.
Yeah, we do. I think it's we're always sort of conscious that there's so many episode suggestions that people make. So I know there'll be quite a few people listening to this bonus who are relatively recent recruits to the Rest is History Club. And you'll have seen on the Discord that we have that thing where we say ideas and people send in ideas. And I always feel incredibly guilty when I look at that. I mean, not incredibly guilty. I feel very
moderately,
very slightly guilty. Because there's this huge list of amazing subjects. And, you know, we obviously just don't get around to doing them all.
But we may do. I mean, we certainly note them.
We
have done episodes suggested by listeners. So
yeah, we have. Absolutely, we have. And we're always trying to. So, you know, we had a review in the Irish Times who said the weekend that said something like, it took them 140 episodes to mention Ireland or something. But I mean, we haven't done episodes.
But that wasn't true.
Was it not true?
No, St. Bridget.
Yes.
It was in the World Cup of Gods again. And and St. Patrick.
Yeah, we had done St. Patrick. I can't believe that the Irish Times missed that. That's shameful.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't done much Italian history.
We've done Roman history.
We've done D'Annunzio, but that was the only Italian history we've done.
One area that we really have missed out is the Renaissance and all that.
Yeah.
Florence, Venice.
Yeah, we haven't done anything about that. No, we haven't done, I don't know, Turkey. We've done one episode on Japan.
Yeah.
There's loads of places that actually, it's just so difficult to... we're not an encyclopedia. I think that's part of it. But we do try to have a bit of variety. So actually, here's a question. Klaus Crop Rotator. There was a big chat about what, because we had chosen, we talked about this in the live stream last week. We had to choose 10 episodes each. And it wasn't, it was billed as our 10 favorite episodes or the 10 best. But the truth of the matter is, it was for a promotion in America. So we were choosing them with an eye to what would newcomers from the United States.
And to give a sense of the range.
And Klaus Crop Rotator says, what is the formula? Why do some episodes stand out more than others? And what's your answer to that, Tom? Do you think there's a secret ingredient that makes some for us, at least as the presenters, what makes an episode come alive?
So there are episodes that surprise me, and I finish them and feel I'm really surprised by those, of which I think the archetype would be General Gordon.
And you could say General Gordon.
I'm sorry, I'm being predictable, but it always sticks in my mind because I was so unenthusiastic about that. I thought it was such a boring topic. I didn't really know anything about it. And I thought that what I would find out would be boring, but it was thrilling. So that was eye-opening. And then there are topics that are exciting for me to do because I've become, again, enthused by them in a way that I didn't. And I would say the Trafalgar ones for me were the archetype of that.
Trafalgar was great because it was a narrative building towards
a spectacular climax.
And there aren't that many subjects. There are some that do that. But sometimes they're more panoramic, aren't they? For example, we did the holidays episodes. They're fresh in my mind because we've been talking to Lucy Lethbridge today. And there we were surveying a lot of ground. There wasn't really a narrative, was there? But I still thought they were fun.
But there are also ones, don't you think, that are just very funny. So I chose the Olympic, the modern Olympics. Both because I did think that they were, again, I had not been expecting to find them as interesting as I think they turned out to be, but also because it featured the corpsing over Dwyer Flonking, which is one of my favorite moments. And the other favorite moment is the wedding of
Kibble
of Attis, the absolute shenanigans
that went on. That's very funny.
So that those are.
I think one of the lovely things about the World Cup series that we did was that proved, not least to our own producers, that you can take quite obscure moments in history. I don't know, the Tupamaros or the Somerton Man story. And actually, they make brilliant podcast subjects, often more satisfying. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did a whole episode. Well, we didn't say a whole episode. We did a 50-minute episode on the whole of the French Revolution. Yeah. And I think I enjoyed it, and I didn't think it was bad. I thought it was a perfectly good introduction, but I'd rather re-listen to you doing Somerton Man.
But, I mean, the reason for that was that in the early stages, we didn't know how long this was going to last. And we were basically thinking, oh, God, we better do the French Revolution. We better do the Second World War.
Yeah.
We were just doing all the greatest
hits.
We could
not have that off for 40 minutes.
Yeah. Whereas now, because I think we feel slightly more confident that this might carry on.
Yeah.
But also, it's because it did have the format of the World Cup. So we were basically forced to come up with something. We had to find something on South Korea Uruguay or whatever. And I think that being forced to come up with a subject that you wouldn't otherwise choose is a stimulus to creativity.
That's a great challenge. It's a great challenge.
So I think the challenge for us is to try and find some other format that would kind of foster that.
Yeah.
And if any of you out there, any listeners, have ideas for a kind of straitjacket, isn't it?
It is a bit. I suppose that the challenge for the podcast in the long run is not to become tired. You know, A, for us not to become self-indulgent, but B, for...
That would never happen.
Well, I think that ship has sailed a long time ago.
Those listeners to the Downton Abbey will soon be finding.
But the truth of the matter is, of course, there's so much material. I mean, human history has so many amazing stories that has more than enough for a lifetime of podcast, I would have thought. Well, I'd hope anyway. All right, let's talk about something other than our own podcast. So what else do we have from Sam? Tom, do you want to ask me that question two down or whatever
it is? So the 27th of January marked 50 years since the US withdrew troops from Vietnam in 1973. How significant was that event in the course of the Cold War? What resonance does it still have today? Does it in any way impact US policy towards Russia's invasion of Ukraine? So lots of questions there.
Lots of questions.
So we've done the Vietnam War, haven't we?
We have. That was absolute folly. We should never have done that in one episode either.
But Dominic, do we have a topic on the Vietnam War coming up?
We do, because what I'd really wanted to do is an episode in the next couple of months about the fall of Saigon in 1975. is sort of a slightly non-canonical Vietnam War moment, because although it's iconic, I mean, it's genuinely iconic, the image of the North Vietnamese tanks crashing through the
helicopters
into the center of Saigon, that obviously happens after America has left. I mean, after America has technically left. The reason that January 1973, I think Nixon gave his speech a little bit earlier, two or three days earlier, is that this is the moment when Nixon claims that he says, we have reached a deal in Paris with the North Vietnamese, and we're going to bring home all our American troops. It's actually a very controversial moment, because if I can sort of get into sort of Open University lecture mode for a second.
Go for it.
Nixon had come to office in January 1969, saying that he was going to somehow bring an honorable end to the war in Vietnam. And actually, that proved much more difficult than I think anybody had imagined. And I think that he got a heck of a lot of stick at the time, particularly from students, who sort of said he's prolonging the war, he's escalating the war. But he's in quite an unenviable position, because I think what hangs over that issue of the US withdrawal from Vietnam is that for more than 10 years, the Americans had made pretty explicit commitments to their South Vietnamese client. We will not allow you to fall, you know. And they'd publicly said South Vietnam is this kind of oasis of democracy and Western values, standing in the way of the sort of falling dominoes. And I think it would have been, it's unreasonable to think that Nixon could just sort of say to the South Vietnamese, well, we made a mistake. We're off home now.
Presumably, because that would then, it would be a blot on American honor.
It would.
And it would alarm all their other allies.
It would. So from the American sort of purely strategic point of view, it would be a bad move. But also there's an argument that it would be just really dishonorable behavior to say to your ally, who you had propped up, and you had orchestrated coups within that ally to get the government that you wanted and whatnot, to then say, actually, it's even quite tough. We're just going to go home.
Sorry.
So then Nixon's forced into this position where he has to kind of escalate the war, because the North Vietnamese have gone into Cambodia, and his generals want him to strike what they call their North Vietnamese sanctuaries in Cambodia, which Nixon does. That outrages a lot of American opinion, completely destabilizes Cambodia as well, by the way. But what Nixon did was he did a policy called Vietnamization. So it was basically replacing American combat units with trained South Vietnamese combat units. And by January 1973, he thinks, well, we've probably bought enough time. We've probably done enough now so that South Vietnam is sort of can slightly fend for itself. But the funny thing about that peace, so Nixon goes on TV and he says, I have the peace with honor that we've always wanted. And, you know, there's this sort of pretense by both the North Vietnam, well, by everybody. Everybody is pretending. Nobody thinks the war's going to end in 73, even though everyone says it's peace. Henry Kissinger and Le Duc Tho, who's the North Vietnamese negotiator, they both get the Nobel Peace Prize. But they both know that the war will resume within days. So what their plan, I think a lot of historians would now say, is that actually they'll just start bombing. As soon as the North Vietnamese move, which they will, because they want to conquer South Vietnam, as soon as that happens, the Americans will just continue, go back to bombing the living daylights out of them. But Nixon can't do that because Watergate hits, his hands are tied by Congress, Congress turns against him. So suddenly the South Vietnamese are on their own. So
we should stop because you are going...
Yeah, sorry.
We're doing the podcast.
I'm getting really carried away. but I think it's funny that it's an interesting anniversary, because it's an anniversary of effectively...
Of a
fake story. Yeah, of nothing.
Fake news. Fake history.
Fake news. But it's also the anniversary of a moment that did undoubtedly leave enormous scar on the American consciousness.
Let's leave this then, because we're going to be talking about this.
So this is sort of the territory of my PhD, Tom.
I know. And that's why I'm looking forward to it, because... You know, people remember your Nixon episodes.
Right.
Tour de force.
Well, you know what? The other reason I wanted to do the fall of Saigon, I won't be talking about this in the episode because it's too shaming, is I have tons of stuff written about it that I was never able to publish.
Brilliant.
Because
this
when
is
I wrote
so exciting.
A book on 70s America. Have I talked about this before?
Yes, you have.
How my first draft was more than 500,000 words long.
Yeah.
And the guy said, you just need to cut hundreds of thousands of words. So I have something like three chapters, two chapters that in the book are literally a sentence. They're just reduced to a sentence.
So including the fall of Saigon?
Yeah.
So can you send it? Can you send it to me?
I will do, yeah.
You know, I'm a big admirer, Dominic. I want to read all your bootleg stuff.
Exactly. It's the bootleg stuff, yeah. Tom. It's the DVD extra.
Yeah. No, I'd love to read the director's cut. So that's something to look forward to. Okay. So Vic Sterling complaining about the live show we did, that we failed to mention Burns. It was Burns night.
Do you know what? I'm not really into Burns
Very
night.
Sad there was no reference to Burns.
Well, I'm not Scottish.
Yeah. Well, I had no idea what day it was, what time it was. I just landed from India. So my brain is completely scrambled. So that would be my defense.
But this is one of these weird things. So I have this quite strong views about this. I think that if
You're
I
an
was
Englishman.
Yeah. And if I think if I was Scottish, just like I think this about St. Patrick's Day, and I might have mentioned this before, I would find it incredibly patronizing.
Yeah.
For my southern neighbours to sort of be dressing up, putting on fake voices,
especially drinking
iron brew,
especially when Burns is so rude about the English.
Yeah, I just think it's fake.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it's fake if you're Scottish, by the way. If you're Scottish, eat as much haggis as you like.
Although Alex Massey, very distinguished columnist, it's almost as traditional as Burns night. He publishes an article complaining about it.
He doesn't rate it.
No, so it's wonderful to see these traditions. You know, they're kind of snowballing, aren't they? They kind of grow over the passage of time.
I'm like an impassioned student union activist at a provincial university.
You're arguing against cultural appropriation.
I don't like cultural appropriation. Yeah,
does he great credit?
I don't agree with wearing a sombrero in a taco.
Well, so talking of cultural appropriation, question from Emma Hopkins. Can you please do an episode on Matthew Flinders, his achievements and legacy? His remains are recently discovered during the HS2 rail project. I understand not many Brits know of his significant career or even who he is.
Tom.
Do you know who he is?
I don't know who he is.
So he was an explorer, cartographer who went around Australia and I think gave it its name.
Well, he called it Australia.
He called it Australia, yeah.
Should have called it Flinders.
Flinders Land.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was Van Diemen's Land.
Okay.
And he called it Australia. But the reason I'm interested in him, and I have heard of him, is that when I was doing a Radio 4 history show, I went to the excavations that they're doing for the new HS2 terminus at Euston in North London. And to do that, they've had to dig up a graveyard, so consecrated ground. And I went into this kind of excavation site. And it was like something from Dante. It was this huge, great pit and coffins were sticking out of the dirt. So it kind of went round in a spiral because they were using the spiral to go down into the depths of the pit.
Right.
And it you know, it was like the seventh circle of hell or something. So they've had to dig up all the coffins, which were, some of them were kind of, you know, pauper's graves and some of them were very kind of posh graves with inscriptions and everything, so they knew who they were. And I gather it's kind of incredible insight into social history of London in the kind of the cusp of the Industrial Revolution, really.
Right.
And likewise, there's a similar cemetery in Birmingham at the other end of the initial stage of HS2, where they're doing the same thing, which in many ways is even more interesting because, of course, Birmingham is, you know, the point of explosive growth. And so they're looking at the bones to measure the effects of the Industrial Revolution on
health. Yeah.
So I think that the impact of that will be enormous. But one of the things was they found Matthew Flinders's grave there. So the man who named Australia.
So that's great news for aficionados of Matthew Flinders. Will we do an episode on him, his achievements and legacy? We might. I wouldn't say never.
I think we'll do one on Captain Cook and maybe we'll give him a mention.
Okay.
Don't you think?
Why not? Yeah. So another Australasian or Oceanian suggestion from Mighty Totara, a Kiwi listener. We need an episode on New Zealand or the Pacific. I'd suggest the amazing story of how Polynesians spread across the Pacific. The great debates among historians about that. Do you know much about this, Tom?
I know enough about it to know that I'm not qualified to talk about it.
Oh, no.
But I'm sure if people can suggest someone who'd be good on that, we'd be very happy to do that. I agree, it is an amazing story.
So one of our listeners, Stephen Clark, has New Zealand heritage, and he suggested that we do an episode about New Zealand prime ministers. Apparently, they're great characters, rather like their Australian counterparts.
Well, so Jacinda Ardern has just resigned, hasn't she?
Right.
So we possibly missed our moment with that.
Well, no, because there'll be an election soon. There's an election coming.
Okay, well, let's hold on to that. And the other one that people are very keen we do is Italian.
Yeah. Well, so our New Zealand prime ministers, he put a clip up or he put a link or something to, there was a prime minister who you may remember, Tom, called Robert Muldoon. And he has the notable achievement, and you can see it on YouTube, he calls an election while drunk.
Okay, we must do that.
It was called the Schnapps election. He's absolutely hammered.
Jacinda would never do that, would she?
No, she wouldn't.
No.
He's slurring his words, and the journalists say to him, this gives you very little time there to campaign, because he sort of said, we'll have an election in 2 weeks or whatever it is. He's absolutely wasted. He says, we'll have an election in, 2 weeks or whenever.
So that's quite Bob Hawke behaviour.
Very Bob Hawke. And they say to him, that doesn't give you very much time. And he says, it doesn't give the opposition much time either. This is obviously a terrible accent.
It's an Australian accent, Dominic.
Yeah, it was. He says, it doesn't give the opposition, but it's slurred, you see, Thomas, the drunkenness.
Yeah,
of course. He's speaking in a silly voice. He says, didn't give the opposition much time either, but the opposition absolutely hammered him in the election, not surprisingly. So,
yeah, maybe. Anyway, okay. Well, let's put that on the list.
Alessandro Smerieri has a very good suggestion. Medieval states that have disappeared but are still sort of lurking around today. So he gives the examples of Scotland, Catalonia, Brittany.
Could include England.
We could include in the Teutonic Order, Navarre, Granada, Novgorod, Lithuania, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. We have talked before about basically doing a Norman Davis, great historian, tribute episodes, because he wrote a brilliant book called Vanished Kingdoms. Really good fun.
But those are ones that have really vanished, isn't it?
Prussia.
Or yes, Klut. Prussia.
Yes. He does do the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Actually, the Byzantine Empire, I think.
It does. He has the USSR. It's slightly uneven because some of them he's writing 10 pages about the USSR. What can you possibly say? But I think we could have a Vanished Kingdom season, Tom.
Yes, we could do that.
You know, we've done Burgundy.
Yeah, so that might focus the mind and oblige us to kind of tackle fields of history we wouldn't otherwise do. And we could do them not just on Europe.
But no, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, there are all kinds of weird South American Vanished Kingdoms. Gran Colombia, which was Bolivar's attempt to create this massive country.
But there were Chinese kingdoms and...
Yeah.
Japanese
All kinds
kingdom.
Of places.
Yeah, so that's quite a good idea. Right. We got time for anything.
Yeah, how about Misty Mulvaney? If you had a time machine, where would you go back to, Tom? What mystery would you like to solve? Well, I think we've said before where we'd go back to, but not what mystery we would solve.
A crucifixion, resurrection.
That's what you'd go to?
Yeah, what happened?
Okay.
It's the biggest mystery of all.
Bigger than the princes in the tower, Tom.
Yes. Yes. Well, we know what happened to the princes in the tower. I'd like to see what actually happened.
Okay. You can't go to both. You can't go to everything. I mean, just one trip. So you'd go for like a city break, basically.
I go for city break to Jerusalem.
A long weekend.
For a long weekend. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Take in the crucifixion and then, the aftermath.
Fair enough.
What about you?
I don't know. I'm now, you've set the bar very high. maybe I'd go to the Texas Book Depository.
Or why Harold Wilson resigned.
I know why he resigned. I don't. Why do people think that's a mystery? It's not a mystery.
But Kennedy assassination isn't a mystery, is it?
No, it's not really. No. Maybe interesting to see it, though. I mean, that's a terribly morbid thing to say. Adventures in Time, the death of JFK.
That would be your choice of an assassination.
No, it wouldn't. Of an assassination?
Yeah.
I have to go back and see an assassination?
Yeah. You can choose any assassination. I mean, you know what I'd choose.
Caesar.
Yeah, and we're going to be doing an episode on that fairly soon.
We are. I don't think I'd choose Caesar because there's a lot of rioting afterwards, so you'd be in fear of your life, wouldn't you?
No, because you'd inherit large sum of money because you could pretend that you were a Roman citizen.
Right. Yeah. I would choose, you know what I would choose? I would choose the assassination of Robert Kennedy because then it's in Los Angeles in 1968. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
You know, I could go and have a sort of, if that was a city break, so a long weekend.
Yeah.
I could just hang around with the Doors or something afterwards. I'm sure we'd get on brilliantly. Similar people.
Do you think the Doors were hanging out after he got assassinated? Were they just kind of jamming?
I think they were probably hanging out generally during that time period, Tom.
Yeah, okay.
Actually, I'd hate that. I don't know why I suggest it. I would find it very... I'd hate their company. I don't see myself and Jim Morrison as soulmates at all. Stephen Clark, he's got another question, and it's a good one. What history book do you wish you had the chance to write, but someone else got in there first?
Well, I remember when I wrote Rubicon about the Roman Republic and its collapse, I wanted to call it Citizens. So Simon Sharma, who called his book on French Revolution Citizens, so he got in definitely with a title I don't know whether that's...
Rubicon is a better title than Citizens.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. But I like Citizens as a title.
Okay. I would say... I tell you, we've got somebody coming on the podcast who's written a book that I would have loved to have done, and that's... We've got Anna Kay coming on to talk about 1650s England. She wrote an absolutely brilliant book about Oliver Cromwell's England. And I had always wanted to read such a book and actually had secretly kind of fantasized about doing it.
Okay, but here's a question. What aspect or field of history do you think there hasn't been a good book written about it and there should be?
Oh,
I say, what is the gap in the market? And this could be popular history or academic history aimed at the general general readership. Shall I tell you mine?
Yeah.
7 Years' War.
Dan Snow has a book on the 7 Years' War, Tom.
No, he doesn't. He has a book on the Siege of Quebec, but he doesn't have a book on the whole of the 7 Years' War. And I keep telling him, go and write this book.
The definitive book. He's too busy making strange video clips and stuff, isn't he?
It's such an interesting topic. And it's so formative.
Yeah, I would choose... I think our former antagonist, Capel Loft, may be doing it.
Oh, yes.
A book on the early days of politics. So, in other words, the Whigs, Tories in Britain.
Yeah.
I would sort of, in my dream...
That's a very good topic.
That would go from kind of the Glorious Revolution through to Walpole or even...
So confusing, so little known.
And there's nothing about it in the shops. I would love to see that.
Okay, so, and there's one last absolutely banging question.
Yeah.
Moritz Adler, what's the one thing in history that, if reversed, would have the biggest positive impact?
The biggest positive impact? The big thing that reversed?
Okay, shall I give my answer?
Yeah, go on.
I mean, it's a sweeping one. Humans never leave Africa.
Africa's very crowded in that scenario, Tom.
No, it isn't. Because we remain what we're meant to be, hunter-gatherers running, you know, across grasslands.
Yeah, that's how you see yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Wrestling with big cats. Exactly. And we never leave. And so therefore, vast numbers of species are left alive. And so we still have large ground sloths.
You've gone against the spirit of the question. They would have the biggest positive impact on the world generally. Definitely, I agree with you, but not on humanity.
I think it would. I think we'd be much happier.
Do you think so? Living in tribes or something?
I think it's what we're meant to be.
Of hunter-gatherers.
That's what we evolved to do.
We've just gone horribly wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what would... Well, if it's an event, I suppose I would take out the First World War.
Good one. Yes.
Because I think if you took out the French Revolution, most of the things the French Revolution is commonly, slightly lazily supposed to have kick-started, they would have happened anyway. Nationalism, you know, republicanism.
I mean, isn't the case of saying the First World War is going to happen at some point anyway?
Yeah.
There's always going to be an explosion. I mean, that's the problem, isn't it?
That is the problem. Yes. I suppose that is the problem. You're right.
And obviously, humans were going to leave Africa. So, I mean, that's a pointless thing as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think of an invention or something, but you can't. Things are invented for a reason. They're not invented by chance.
Have you read The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity by David Graeber and David Wengray? But you read about it.
Anarchists.
I think one of them is an anarchist. One of them is a very distinguished historian of actually proto-Egypt.
Right. And it's a sort of claim that...
Say the kind of monumental hierarchical civilization that Egypt, of which Egypt is the representative, wasn't inevitable.
Yes. Yeah.
So I don't want to comment on it because I haven't read it, but I think it's an interesting sounding book.
The thesis is that basically we could have been less authoritarian, less hierarchical.
We could and can be.
Yeah, we could and can be. So it's simmering underneath the history is a vision of a world that could, you know, to basically say the range of possibilities is greater than we imagine.
Yeah, I think that's the argument of it. So I wouldn't want to comment on it until I've read it, but it does sound very interesting.
It offends my Hobbesian view of the world, Tom.
I know, the kind of natural pessimism. But that is a book that perhaps contains the answers.
Every school has to have prefects. It's just the way of the world.
And on that bombshell, I think that is time
to say... fall back on my favourite analogy.
A 1920s boarding school. We will say goodbye to you all. Thank you very much for listening. And we will be back on tomorrow, being Thursday, with Downton Abbey. Next week with the Cathars. And back next week with more of this kind of conversational
stuff. Worthless wittering.
So we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.